Third, I'm going to put everything in context. You probably saw in the video and what Sean was talking about, the meat and all that. Latin American left is full, absolutely full, riddled with meat, and that's the reality of it. So in the face of the meat, you can take always two options. One is to take throw away the baby with the bathroom, what you say?
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is to just go along and believe the whole meat. Those are the two more typical responses, but in fairness, and I want to be quite fair with the social process of Latin America, they face an enormous number of contradictions and a very complex situation. As you could see there, it's not just, as you could put it, the struggle between the two classes. It's that plus a tradition of dependency. And by dependency, I don't mean that we are asking for handles to the outside world, but dependency, it's a method of interaction at an economic level with the outside world, where you don't put the economic dynamics of your own country, where your country just goes along with whatever investment or whatever influx of capital comes from the outside. So basically, we respond to an ever-changing market outside, and we have to kind of go along with the different kind of currents, you know. That's the reality of Latin America, and you have whole countries like Venezuela turn as a Latin American writer from the 60s said, into country oil, country stain, country copper, country bananas, and every single country gives to international capitalism whatever international capitalism requires. And when international capitalism requires something different, then we are quick to change that, but at no point we sit down and think of what we need. And there is a sort of development that matches or fulfills the needs of the local population. You can see this quite well in many parts of the region there. That's a legacy of dependency for, it's not a recent thing, it's for numerous centuries. That in these sort of economies in Latin America, you have very dynamic areas like oil, like copper, where workers are well paid often, and they have a lot of job security and so on, while at the same time you have huge pockets of poverty and destitution wherever imperialism has no interest in your country. And that sort of development is what's been called dependent development. So if the US needs for instance, copper, in the case of my country, I used to work in the copper mines in Chile. You have a very clear map of infrastructure, electricity, development, and so on. From the mine to the port where it goes off to the US, and the rest of the country is completely left to whatever. It doesn't matter, you know, it's not relevant. So it's not a view from the people in terms of what are the needs of the country and so on. You could say it's the same in most countries, but in Latin America and in Africa in a different way, it's in a much more dramatic way. So you're dealing with a number of very strong contradictions, and I think that often the anarchist movement in Venezuela, and I have to say I'm very critical of it, took it the wrong way, and a lot of people were criticizing Chavez for doing dealings with the US instead of focusing in the real debate that was what conditions are those you do dealings with the US. What I want to say is that it's not a matter for a country that has many decades and many centuries of dependency of saying, well, from now on we don't sell a drop, as Charlie was saying, a complete hollow and unbelievable threat that he can periodically do all the time, because the US, Bush, Putin and the EU, they all know it's not going to be made a reality. Because he can't afford doing it. I mean, he said, I want to sell a single drop of oil to the US. And Bush is laughing. He says, and what do you do with that oil? To the Chinese, they won't buy it all, and that only will increase the competition with Africa and with other places. So it's not a matter of doing that, but are the conditions in which you do it. And certainly at that point, the criticisms are far more necessary and what you saw the workers there, certainly something that I debated is going on in the left wing movement in Venezuela. Unfortunately, it's still dominated by this kind of, I don't know, even sort of
No.
I want to say about the figure of Chavez, but it seems a very kind of mythological way, you know, kind of like. Like the person was saying at the end, the caretaker of the machine was saying at the end, oh, he's a good man, but it's like a divine figure. It's beyond good, it's beyond evil, you know, it's beyond everything, it's beyond criticism, sacred. You see, it's still dominated by that, but at the same time, it has to be put again into the context of what has happened for the last 70 years in Venezuela. Now in Venezuela you have an awful lot of schools, an awful lot of hospitals, and that's a good thing, and you can criticize that, you know. But there are many buts apart from that, you know. So it's obvious that if for the first time a doctor visited you, or for the first time your kids had the chance to learn how to read and write, that man you will never forget. I remember I met some Venezuelans here a couple of months ago, and they would just say, yeah, you can say whatever you want to tell us, you know, but you see this eye, I couldn't see with it, you know. And obviously that's something that you take into account. So for that people, the figure of Chavez is always going to be a kind of sacred figure, and no matter the blunders, no matter how you can, you can see the number of things that are not going the right way, an awful lot of people will support. And what means is that on the one hand it's going to be difficult to go back to the pre-Chavez years, but on the other hand it's going to be difficult as well to move much forward if you don't develop a healthy and revolutionary criticism from the bottom up. So the situation from that point of view is a complicated one. The people that were in power before Chavez will always point to Chavez and say, oh no, he can do the schools, he can do the hospitals because of the oil and because of favor of price. And you go like, no, listen, but wait a second, now get serious. And you have to deal with the right wing as well. You know? Now get serious. For 80 years, Venezuela has been exploiting oil. And you never put health, you never put education, because it wasn't a priority. And you had the same capacity of doing it. But what happened, and the prices were up and down all the time, so it's becoming to a point where huge sectors of Venezuelan society out of the oil enclaves are starting to get some sense of social security. And that's for sure is true. But there are other problems, and the biggest problem is that the Chavismo has not been able to break the circle of dependency I was talking about. We talk about socialism, we talk about an awful lot of things, but still Venezuela is a country that depends in imports of food. So you extend the level of social security, that means people have, among many other things, more money to spend, but what happens is that the price of food goes up, the price of just basic stuff that are not produced in the country, because it's all focused on oil production, starts going up. So that creates more and more problems, and what you have now is a wave of criminality that it's huge, and I'm not saying it's all media hype, it's actually a real thing, number of stabbings, attacks and so on, just to get some basic stuff. Plus the I wouldn't say embargo, but the black market, the stimulation of the black market in Venezuela means at the moment that a number of items are starting to get difficult to get. Stuff like, for instance, chicken, rice, just daily food staples, you know. So there is a situation of a process that is kind of stagnant. And I remember back in 98, we had a lot of discussions back, I was still in Chile then, we had a lot of discussions of how progressive Chavez was. It was the first kind of progressive government since the 70s in Latin America, in a wave of neoliberalism. And just remember discussing with people and all that, you know, the conclusion to what we arrived is that Chavez appeared to be far more left-wing than what he actually was, because the social movement was very backwarded. And we said, but for how long will this last? And we said, well, to the point when the social movement can actually move even further. And that you could see in 2002, and 2002 was a breaking point in the development of the regime in Venezuela. Up to then, Chavez was talking all the time about participatory democracy, was talking all the time about, but when people started making it a reality, with the general strike by the oil bosses, started becoming a bit more cautionary, and the talk of participatory democracy disappeared altogether. It's not mentioned anymore. All the talks on workers' participation was gone altogether. He was talking until then quite a lot, and when workers made it a reality, then the situation changed. And I want to bring parallels with other reformist experiences, like Chile back in 72 as well. There was another boss's strike, a lockout, you would call it here, yeah. A boss's lockout, and the workers took over the factories in October 72. The first movement of the government, instead of stimulating workers to go along with the process, was send trade union bureaucrats to convince the workers to hand back the factories, and to install military ministers to give security to the army in order to prevent future coup. That didn't happen, because less than 1 year later he was deposed anyway by US interference. So we have again the state as an institution not only being unreliant and being kind of suspicious of independent and autonomous initiative, but at the same time we had the same progressive government forgetting all the discourse, forgetting everything they said, and actively sabotaging that popular movement. That's a paradox that we find today, and we can take, again, with that paradox, we can take two positions, and I think, again, the anarchist movement in Venezuela failed to take the right one. One is to say, okay, we go with Chavez to the very end, because it's necessary, and then imperialism will take over anyway. Or the other option is to say, we step out completely of the Chavista movement, and we kind of even get to the extreme of endorsing any sort of opposition. But that happened, and you could see anarchists in Venezuela marching with right-wing students. That was completely disgraceful. You could see even Maoists, because Maoists have a tendency to, whether you're with them or against them, but it's kind of pretty marked. The Maoists actually forming the first... I wouldn't call them a group of choke. How do you call, like, what the fascists have? It's kind of gangs to clash with people. No, but it's not militias, but it's more like the fascists in England, you know, they would have like kind of groups to clash with.
Like church?
Yeah, kind of groups of action groups of the right wing that were formed by Maoists. And that started actually in 98, 99. So they start quite early with that trend. So the problem we have now is, with all progressive governments, you have certainly a people that supports them. You certainly have people that believe that they're beyond criticism. At the same time, you have a number of changes happening in the political and social structure that are positive, and there's no denial of that. But at the same time, you know that they won't go beyond a certain point, and you know that the people will need to go beyond a certain point if you want those changes to last, and you know at the same time that the expectations created sooner or later will be boosted. The problem Chavez has now is that in 2008, that means 10 years after he started, many of the expectations he created were crushed, and were crushed not by the right wing or by the inability to do that, but because the workers found themselves wanting to go ahead and being kind of with the reins put on them. And that happened a number of times, and you have Chavez talking about the ultra left, people being irresponsible. Well, people were actually just trying to make sure that the the so-called believer in process doesn't go to the back. We want it to go forward, but that's the thing. What's the dead end of it? You have a similar situation in Bolivia. You have a similar situation in Ecuador, and in most places, what happened was that the popular movement has been increasingly institutionalized, has been increasingly bureaucratized, and when the people leave the streets, as we say, and moves into the palace of government, then fascism is quite quick to take over to the street. Bolivia is it's very exemplary of that, with all the discussion, I don't know if you've been following it through the news, the discussion of autonomous regions in Bolivia. No? Well, kind of. What happened is that there was very active workers, peasants movements, and they all got entangled discussing the new constitution, because they were calling for a constituent assembly. And while in the meantime, the fascists started going more and more militant to the streets, with racist attacks, with attacking workers' rights, and saying that if any socialist aspect was approved in the constitution, they would declare autonomy for the regions. And that puts a paradox, whether you fight for socialism through a constitution or you fight for socialism on the streets. And when people lost the streets, the fascists took them. And they put immediately a popular movement that was on the offensive for 15 sustained years on the defensive. And again, the focus was changed from social change to the need to keep the government. And everyone closes ranks to say, no, we have to defend this government, even at the expense of forgetting the social demands that were supposed to be carried on by the government. So, with this, what I want to say is that there are no easy answers, and certainly you have to be, particularly if you are in a minority position, like us anarchists, you have to be having links with the people, and that means working alongside Chavistas in the case of Venezuela, or Masista in the case of Bolivia, or Correita in the case of Ecuador. The thing is, again, how do you work? It's again, how do you can work with the popular movement, support what is necessary to support, while at the same time always having the argument that anarchists should be defending to preserve the working class autonomy, to preserve the initiative from the bottom up, to fight for democratization of the people's organizations, and at the same time to fight for a different type of democracy, a direct democracy, a participatory democracy. Understanding that you have to defeat dependency, understanding that you have to face numerous problems like illiteracy and so on. Those are kind of the contradictory position that puts you the reformist circumstance. I don't know if anyone wants to ask something at this point or make any comments.
I would say, obviously, you support them reforms, and obviously, as an anarchist, you think that them reforms were wrong for people taking the streets, or that the government need to concede them in order to maintain its position that's holding them apart. I would say Chavez is similar to what the Labour government done here in the 50s, radical reforms. Mm-hmm. The Labour government nationalised oil, free education, healthcare. Well, it's not, it's not such things as free lunch, but anyway, you get my point. So, Labour governments, 50s and 60s, all that has to be supported. And the dilemma which you were talking about today, I think it's quite similar to the dilemma maybe in Russia in 1917, Spain in 1936 and elsewhere. And we've seen that in the film between the oil workers who knew that they could take the initiative, that they could run the factories based on workers' control, no problem. But it was the government, the so-called revolutionary government, who was cutting back them. So I agree that you need to work within mass movements, but maintain our independence and our autonomy at the same time. That's where people actually have to be with that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned another thing that's very important. You mentioned the governments of the 50s and all that, and I think that the reason why, in fairness, Chavez, I see a number of the kind of left-wing icons of the 90s in Latin America are seen as big socialists is because of the neoliberal offensive that was led at the time. I mean, all the region was so right-wing that you could come and talk about free education, that something that people in Denmark would take for granted, you know? Oh. And it appears to be a revolutionary demand. What brings me back again to the point of what is really a revolutionary demand. And a revolutionary demand depends greatly on the context you're in. You know, obviously, if you were in revolutionary Spain back in 1936, and all your demands was free education, free health, you would have been the mildest of the reformists around. You know, whereas if you were maybe in Ireland in the 30s and the 40s, that would have been quite radical at the time. So, yeah, Charles appeared to be a very radical figure. Where in fairness, there's nothing that was in Charles' program, apart from participatory democracy, that he completely got rid of that, that was particularly threatening for any Western force. I mean, to any, the concept of any Western democracy. The problem is that the number of sovereign measures, because of the dependency from mainly the big powers of the world, US, mainly the US, the EU as well to a lesser degree, but mainly the US, means that the more democracy you have, the more it gets out of their control. Yes. And if you talk about participatory democracy, the position of the US against Chavez was not for what he was doing, but what he potentially could do if he was coherent with what he was saying. With time, it's been proved that he's quite willing to roll back. For instance, Obama now said that his new emphasis is going to be on Latin America instead of the Middle East if he wins. Immediately, Chavez changed his course. Because, you know, to a great extent, the progressive governments in Latin America for the first part of the 21st century had it kind of easy because the attention of the US was somewhere else, apart from Colombia. That's completely a different story. I can talk about that more if you want, because that's kind of an area that I've been working with for a number of years. But in the case of Chavez, he immediately said, "Oh, of course, when Obama wins, you know, we're going to be more than willing to cooperate, even with the war on drugs." And you go like, "And we're going to again accept DEA presence, and we want to dialogue on that because it's a big issue." And you go like, "Jesus Christ, you know what you're talking about, the war on drugs." That's the same as the war on terror in the Middle East. It's a wrong version of imperialist intervention. And that cannot be concealed under any disguise. If anyone talks about the Plan Colombia being a war on drugs, I mean, you just have to see the results and the coca production has expanded actually 27% since the implementation of Plan Colombia. And that proves you that it was nothing to do with drugs. It was mainly a struggle against, yeah, small coca farmers, so they were displaced. Big drug dealers came, took their lands, and business kept going on, not as usual, but even more than usual. So, and obviously to beat the popular movement and social organizations and so on. So yeah, that's one thing of the context, but on another scenario, I think that revolutionaries really have to look into the capacity to do alliances. I come from a tiny minority of the revolutionary movement in Latin America, that is anarchism. And from anarchism, we come even from another kind of minority that's called anarcho-communism, or capitalism, as they call it here, or whatever. So when you're a minority, and I like explaining these things about options, because you have many options in your political activity, you don't do things because in a mechanical way, you can always look into options. When you're a minority, a revolutionary minority, you can do two things. One is to completely isolate yourself, think that you have the absolute truth, and be nothing more than an irrelevant joke for most of the working class that will receive a pamphlet of you and will think it's curious, like any sex talking about UFOs or whatever. You know, you can be as relevant as that. Or alternatively, you can accept, yeah, shit, we're small. So we know that we're not going to do the revolution on our own, and we have to build up a force with other people. The thing is, again, how much stock do we put into a right policy, into a correct politics of alliance in anarchism? I don't think we do. Or not much, really. How much effort do we put in terms of accepting what are the core elements of your politics that you can give in, and what are areas that you can actually come to compromise with our revolutionary forces in terms of advancing your own cause? You don't put much thought, even in terms of the anarchist organization. Very few anarchists are really serious on the need of an organization. And if you want to keep your autonomy, your the independence of your ideas, you always need to have an organized core that you can say, no, this organization, there's where we stand, instead of fuminating into a broader social movement that happens very dramatically to the movement in Mexico. The anarchist movement in Mexico is one of the most active anarchist movements I've ever seen. It's one of the bigger anarchist movements as well. And it's probably the anarchist movement with the least capacity to influence political events in Mexico. Though they have all the potential to do it, but they don't have the organization. So therefore they don't have a sanctuary of their own where they can think their politics, when they can have political discussions at a high level with respect to constructively. That doesn't exist. And that's something that I think in Ireland we're quite fortunate in having at least one kind of national functioning organization that really gives you that capacity. And that obviously means that no matter the WSM as an organization, it's far from being a perfect organization. I'll be one of the most critical people inside of the organization itself. I don't know if you, I haven't gone into the thread in a long time, but I'm always criticizing everything. But far from being perfect, still, it's an organization that gives us more of a capacity to influence events. And you can actually see a difference. I mean, we can push well above our weight. The same could be said to most parts where communist organizations do exist in South America. You have them in Chile, you have them in Peru, in Ecuador recently, in Argentina, in Uruguay, in Brazil. And those are areas where the anarchist movement actually has been able to move to create serious mass movements, still minority movements, but sizable minorities. But you have to take into account if you want to do politics. And that puts you again into a different step when you want to push forward for your own political agenda. In Chile, for instance, where I come from, the two main areas of work of anarchism over the last while has been the homeless movement and the students' movement. When we started the FEL, the Students Libertarian Network, we were just 7 people. That was some time ago. Today's organization over 500 students with the capacity to stage national demonstrations. And that's all because we had that sense of organization, but at the same time because we were where the social movement was. I remember when we formed it, a number of people blamed us for being reformists, for participating in the same federations as the Communist Party and as other ones, because there was where the student movement was. And yet, still there are other anarchists that formed their own sects. They were very fervent believers, but overall they were unable to move forward the student struggle. And that was, and that became all too evident when the FEL had a paramount role on the student struggles 2 years ago. I don't know if any one of you saw them. They were all over the place in the news. Every single school in Chile was stopped. Even Easter Island. Never nothing happened in Easter Island. But every single school stopped, and the students occupied them. There was one day only, you had 1 million students out on the streets protesting, demonstrating, and it was all work of the anarchists. To the point that I remember 15 years ago, if you said you were an anarchist, people would look at you like, what's that? When you say today that you're an anarchist, you get two reactions that kind of like, oh, well, they know what you're talking about. Or some other people would get scared because you're kind of demonized by the media and all that, and call it, oh no, so you're the people that goes around putting petrol bombs and buses and stuff, you know, like, well, not quite, but yeah, some lads do. Anyway, whatever the case, is that I think that was a very successful politics of alliance, while at the same time the anarchists were able to keep their own politics. And I just remember, again, when I was first a student officer, that was back in 1996, I just remember telling in a student's assembly, well, now we should move the decision-making bodies from the council of students to the assemblies, and we should have permanent assemblies and all that. And the people the students themselves said, oh no, but that wouldn't work, that's over bureaucratic and stuff like that. That's what they said, you know. When I was in 2006 back in Tira for the student struggles, I went there. I just remember being in an assembly and someone proposing, well, let the council decide it, and people were, no, decisions are made in the assembly. That was a massive shift in common sense. You know, the commons, and I realized that the common sense vast sections of the popular movement have changed. And that's, and yet still, probably 2% of those students will claim to have any sympathies to anarchism. But anarchism was successful enough to change the common sense. And that, I think, is a very big struggle. With the homeless movement, it was kind of a similar thing. When we first started, we identified people not having homes as a big problem. It's, homelessness is different in Chile than here, by the way. So you don't end up on the street if you're homeless, because we have far stronger social links. So basically what happens is that the house...
that way. It's going that way more.
Well,
not the same extent that public companies.
No, but what I want to say is that what happens in Chile is that you can't get help, and it's very seldom that someone ends up in the street. I mean, if you end up on the street, it means that you're basically a madman. You have mental problems, and your family don't want to look after you because they've no money to send you to a sanitarium, you know. So every single person you see on the street, living on the street, is someone with basically mental issues. But
is there full housing then? So everybody has a...
No. What happens is that in the house of your parents, you have six families living inside. So it means that...
Well, there's a crowded housing stuff.
So you have... Yeah, but really crowded. So that has even problems with the hygiene and with a number of things. So you have, I don't know, a place, maybe like, let's say half of this, and you have three, four families living here. So pretty much as you saw in the house of your man there, this is the bed of my son, this is the bed of... But often you don't even have, this is the bed of my family. That's what you have, you know, when in a two-people bed, you put... 6, 7 kids, plus you and your wife. So that was a big problem, and we because of a number of reasons, taking over land was not as easy as it was until the 80s, because it was a huge mass movement, you know, and people could afford to take over land, and the cops had far more other priorities than repressing land takers. So there's a shanty towns group, so that wasn't happening. And we decided to start forming communities to defend local housing, to start demanding local housing from the government. And that was, as you said, a measure that was not given; it was a measure taken by the people themselves. How successful we were with that, it's a bit more tough. Certainly we brought the problem to the attention, and certainly things happened, but up to the moment the struggle for housing is sort of still in the making. It started around 2004, 2005. The first community that roughly, you form a community and you had 30 families, 20 families, but now you form a community and you get easily 200 families from the start, you know, and there you form organizations like APSD, like Lucha Vivienda, that had each one of them 4,000, 5,000 families. So it's like each family of 6, 7 people. And people willing to go out there and struggle for housing. You know? Yeah, to get to that point, it required that us enter into alliance with other forces on the left. It wasn't an easy... Most of the time there weren't easy alliances, because there were people that were quite serious and talked to you face to face, this is where you're, and you knew where they were standing. But you had people noted remarkably, the Communist Party, that were particularly dishonest and were always kind of, but still you needed to be where they were, and that was a huge dilemma. But overall you could put, just to finish this, overall you could put that we managed to actually change a number of aspects in the way that people make politics and assemblies. The fact that negotiations didn't happen three times with the same negotiator, but there was rotation, and all those things were installed by anarchism. And
just finished off saying how far important, it's not where you are, it's where it's where it's hard. One of my beliefs is it's where the class is at and not where you want it to be or where you perceive them to be. I think it's very important because the two men in the left, you know, they become irrelevant because they start from where they're at rather than trying to engage within where the class are at. By and large, most of the working class people aren't where anarchism is at. They're actually involved in day-to-day living and struggle. I think that when you talked about the geopolitical, it's also about timing as well, because if you look where Chavez came before in recent years, you're right, he was surrounded by right-wing neoliberalist things, so people see them more of a revolution because of the circumstances geopolitically. But if you look at Haven, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, you know, people were taking on imperialism in the Vietnam War, there's people in these streets around here taking on British imperialism as well, and so the slogan of a socialist republic, the first British Republic, people had that in their minds, people thought that was a realistic target because of the timing, because of the place, and because of the mass people involved in struggle at the same time as well. When it comes to alliances, I think it's very important that the anarchists need to discuss these and learn from the past mistakes and learn from past lessons and learn from those situations they've won. For myself, you know, I've been involved in various alliances. I'll give you two examples. You talked about homelessness. I was involved in a campaign called Street Scene. It was a newspaper set up for Street Scene. So on one side you had dealing with the NGOs and getting blankets and all that stuff as well for practical issues for the homeless people in the streets. And the other hand, you had in Dublin, you had people marching in the streets, occupying and through the streets as well. So you had two different forms of activity within it. One for people who don't want to involve this reaction, but the message was getting out in both areas. In relation to the anti-racism stuff, I was involved in the anti-racism network. Again, within that, there was an alliance of all different groups within it. Again, the trade union movement, getting NGOs as well, but at the same time, you had those, and preparations were going on within the area who were forming squads, who were going to actually go on the offensive and defensive at the same time. And with other groups, like the Fresh Start Campaign Neighbour, they were allowed to support individual members within the ARN, but on the outside, you know, they were organising their own thing. So you had people in the anti-racism movement who were involved in stuff, which involved the NGOs and involved working class people within working class communities and stuff. But the other side of the spectrum, you had people prepared to go on the defensive, right? So within alliances, you know, the lesson that I've learned is that, you know, if you're in an alliance and it's been pulled to the right, you try to pull it back, right? Because it's working class politics is important. If you can't pull it back, well and good, but if you can't pull it back, it's that tactical point when you step outside and pull the best with you to go on the offensive elsewhere. And I think it's an important debate that needs to be had within the lenses, because if you look back at what you said there about the word anarchism, isn't that kind of people go, you're an anarchist, whereas years ago people turn around and go, Jesus, you're an anarchist, so you're carrying bombs and all. This all stems from, you go back to the anti-globalisation and the capitalist movement. You know, but back in the part of the assembly, 2000, 2001, you've seen hundreds of young people marching through the streets of Belfast, some called them anti-globalisation, some called them a capitalist, and you've seen mass demonstrations stemming from Seattle right through to Genoa, which I was at, through to Geneva and stuff. And so the word itself, because of the geopolitics and entertainment, became accepted as this is an anti-capitalist movement. And we couldn't see it manifested in mass movements on the street, then it became accepted that how long there is anti-capitalist. It wasn't a bad word, it was a word that people associate, people were prepared to demonstrate from across an alliance of movements. There was people there from churches, there was anarchists, all different people come together. So I think it's tactics, it's geopolitics, and it's also timing, which is essential when discussing and getting involved in alliances, because the history shows it, and you learn the lessons of both the victories and the defeats, and I think it's important to take them both.
To me, building alliances is not just for the sake of building alliances as such. I've no problem, obviously, when it comes to local campaigns, like, for example, the water charges, we cooperate with other groups or anyone. Obviously, most people don't share our politics, like, to me, you have to look at that way in terms of cooperation. Like, I've just two questions as well for you. Patty, just regarding especially Bolivia and struggle against water privatisation, what do you think we can learn from that in terms of the current campaign against here, against the water charges? Privatization. And secondly, you mentioned that we're a minority in Latin America, and that may be true today, but then I'm sure you're aware historically it hasn't been the case, especially with in spaces like Cuba and elsewhere, Argentina, there was the early origins of labor mass built anarchist movements. It was revolved around mainly cannabis syllabus ideas. So it's not really a minority. This has always been building mass movements, connecting with people on day-to-day issues in the workplaces, around the workplace housing. For example, that's what we seek to do here in WSN in Belfast and in Ireland. Like, so I produce a newspaper, 10,000 copies, and distribute in Beach Mountain and elsewhere. We're looking at the struggles we're trying to see what we can do at the minute, like water charges, working around that, housing. So we're all, it doesn't necessarily mean building alliances with the left groups to seek it, but we have our own strategic areas where we, but we're also appropriate where the situation arises.
Yeah, on the water struggle thing, believe it, the first thing is to show how evil capitalism can be, to the point of making water unavailable to a lot of people because they couldn't afford it. That obviously spawned a number of protests and the people could actually defeat it, and that was a turning point of the neoliberal way in Latin America. When the Cochabamba Wars happened back in the year 2000, that was the point where all of Latin America got the message, yeah, the people can defeat neoliberalism. Up to then, all the message you were getting since 1998 was, you can have a progressive government to defeat it.
Yeah.
You know? So there were two very different approaches. In the case of Bolivia, what happened was that, you could defeat it, but then again, and that brings relevant revolutionary politics, what you do after you defeat privatization. And I think that that's the most painful situation at the moment. Because, yeah, people say we want a participatory system, pretty much self-managed system, so it's all fine. But you have clientelism inside of the company, you have corrupt trade union leadership, you have a very, very, very low level of investment in the water services, and all those things obviously play against it, you know. And I think that one of the, probably the biggest lessons that we should learn as anarchists is how difficult social change is, and how important it is to look not only from the grand ideological perspective, but from the logic of the grand ideas on social change, but actually how to bring it about in a realistic way. Not in 50, 60 years, but in 2 years, in 3 years, and that was a discussion we had in WSM, what the program was like. Wait a minute, fucking problems, you know. Not, we know what our society would look like, but we don't know how we want Ireland to look like in 5 years. And that's the relevant discussion, really. And the other one has to be a guiding light. You know where you're going. You know, as David was saying, do you know where you are? Do you know where you want to be? But you need to know as well what road you want to walk. And that's the most difficult thing, I think, in the case of Bolivia. Still, you have extremely mature people with a lot of experience at grassroots level, but yes, being kind of entangled into the bureaucracy of state politics over the last while. But I think that the conditions are there for, I mean, there's not going to be a rollback to neoliberalism there, but the important thing is how you move it forward. So that's the first thing. Then on alliances, I want to be clear, yeah, alliances are not for the sake of it. Alliances are necessary for victory, and it's true, I don't want alliances for the sake of it. If, and there are in politics, it's not like mathematics. When you have in mathematics, always 2 and 2 are going to be 4. You know, sometimes in politics, 2 and 2 can be 4 minus, and that's our reality. It's not for the sake of it, but when you're in a minority position, you need alliances, and it's imposed. Not only by, and even if you're not in a minority position, it's desirable to have alliances because you don't want to be seen pretty much as here we come and we impose our ideas. You need to create bridges of dialogue because you are just one part of the people. And whether we like it or not, it's very hard, and I don't picture it, and I don't think it's even desirable to think a society where 100% of people are anarchists. We believe that in anarchism there are tools for a different society. I don't think it's going to be a utopian. I'm an enemy of utopias in general. And I don't approach that way anarchism. I approach anarchism, as I said, as a tool to change society in a more democratic way, in a more participatory way, guaranteeing higher levels of equality, etc. You know, society that will be improving all the time. But we have a role to play, certainly. And if we as anarchists don't play a role, we are doomed. And the authoritarian turn of most revolutions are there as a testimony of what happens when anarchism are not up to the historical task of playing the wrong role. I think that you can discuss alliances when you don't discuss the organisation of anarchists, you know, because as long as anarchism doesn't solve the problem of organisation in its own ranks, then what alliance are you talking about? There's no alliance, you're just entering someone else's game. You know, when you have your own organisation, when it's clear, and I think that, and that's one of the reasons why probably I'm an orthodox adherent of the platforms, because it actually did solve the problem of organisation. You need at least four things to have a functioning organisation, and that's the absolute minimum, it's the basic, you know, an agreed set of ideas, an agreed set of tactics to achieve those ideas, a sense of collective action and discipline in the organisations, therefore we carry out what we are supposed to, and a federal structure. That's what makes us different to the rest of the organisation, where democracy flows organically from the bottom up. And that's what makes us different from socialism of the Leninist type, you know. So, as long as we don't resolve that problem, that we need to have a political organisation that is not just a front of whatever social movement, you know, a political organisation that doesn't exist because of a certain struggle, and when that struggle is over, the organisation disbands. An organisation that can actually go through cycles of struggles, that can go through the ups and downs of the popular movement, learn from that experience, and keep some historical record of them. You know, as long as we don't have them, there's no point in talking about alliances. When you have that, you know clearly what role you're going to play into an alliance. You know clearly what point you need to break with the alliance if you have to, or look for a new way forward. You know clearly where to look for them. If it's anarchists, you don't collectively discuss where you want to go for. You won't know what's the ideal person to go with. You know, and alliance at the same time is not a marriage. It doesn't mean that we enter an alliance with some other group or some other political force and we stay with them until the end of time. No, alliances are for specific goals, and that's the way they should be. And if you try to, and they actually never work for any longer than that. Coming back to the third point you raised about anarchism being a majority in Latin America, yeah, Latin America was the place out of Europe where anarchism was an absolute majority, apart from Korea, to some exceptional circumstance, where anarchism was the majority of the people's movement back in days until the 50s in some parts, or still the 30s in others. But the decline of anarchism was as well something that I seen, and it was a lack of a political view. It was the anarchists did something that worked. It was an art syndicalism. It worked for a while. It worked very well, but it got stuck and rigid and very inflexible in that approach. And when circumstances changed, they were not able to face the new circumstances. The clearest example, I can put it, the example I know the best is Chile again. You know, anarchism was very, very strong. You had a military dictatorship in 27 that posed the first problem, because trade unions could survive when you had some sort of legality around. There's no point in being a trade union in clandestine conditions. And the fact that the trade unions completely disappeared, but the anarchists didn't have the political structures in place to keep going on with a political structure. But while the dictatorship was taking place between 27 and 31, a massive change happened, and was that legal trade unions appeared. And for the first time, anarchists were put into a situation where they said, it didn't matter that all the workers were going to those unions and said, no, we'll keep around structures, we won't join them. But the other, the legal trade unions had the capacity to collectively bargain, to fight for basic stuff as pensions and so on. And a lot of the gains of the working class were actually carried by the anarchists, and the anarchists are very well respected and well remembered in Chile because of that history. But when circumstances changed, they couldn't adapt to that. And the only other historical time anarchists came to be, well, in Cuba it was a similar situation, but in Chile, the only other time that they came to be very relevant later in history was the 50s. And in the 50s was when the anarchists decided to join formal and legal trade unions. And they joined where the workers were, and they proved to workers that there was another way of doing trade unionism, And they actually turned the Tegan movement from a very legal, the trade union movement from being a very legalistically mild reformist trade union movement into a movement that 2 years after the anarchists formed the coup could do a general revolutionary strike with occupations of factories. In just 2 years. So it proved right the case of anarchists. Then some other bad options were taken that meant the decline again of anarchism. Until it came up to be a living political phenomenon in the mid-80s during the dictatorship of Pinochet until, but it really took off with the 90s because of changing circumstances as well, the end of the Cold War, the disorientation of most of the left, the emergence of indigenous movement. I think that the emergence of indigenous movement in Latin America is crucial for anarchism, particularly the Zapatistas, for one reason, because they moved the debate on the left from a quantitative debate into a qualitative debate. But this means that it wasn't just a matter of, as your man was saying, the documentary of do you want more money or less money, do you want more land or less land if you're a peasant. But the indigenous movement turned the debate into a qualitative state. What type of life do we want to lead? And there anarchism had certainly far more to say than most of the socialist currents. And again, to build up a movement, a revolutionary movement, has a number of challenges. What are the challenges when you're involved into the revolutionary struggle? Those are far more difficult challenges. With the homeless movement, we have a very tough situation. For instance, we started talking to people about free housing provided by the state, you know, because you're paying your taxes and so on. And it's not that the state gave it or whatever, it's because the state robs the money from the people, and we want the money to be at least, to we decide, for us to decide where we want the pressure, some of the money to be allocated again, you know, and given back to the people by struggle. So we went and talked to people, and some people said, like, oh no, but you see, that's the problem with the people in the left, you know, you get a bit lazy, and you want everything free. And we don't want everything free. I mean, we're hard workers. We want to pay for a house. The problem is that we can't afford a house. And he says, shit, what do we do? You know, liberalism really took deep roots in Chile. And we have to face it. That was the reality of the working class. So we came up and said, well, we can demand mortgage for poor people. And what's mortgage for poor people? Well, 15, 20 euro, maybe, you know. And that's all you can pay. And we want to pay, so we can demand that social housing costs that. And that actually was quite successful. And we could win a number of struggles on that. You know? Because we were in tune with the mentality of the people, but at the same time we were kind of exposing the contradictions of the system. And it didn't mean that we stopped doing ideological work. So, we made the homeless movement take off. You know? People started feeling that, yeah, I agree with that, you know. I don't want to be seen as a bum. I want to pay because neoliberalism washed my brain, so I brainwashed me, you know, so I don't want to be seen as a bum. I want to pay, but I'm paying something tokenistic. That was when it started. 2-3 years later, the people were demanding free social housing. But that wouldn't have been possible without a process of struggle, without a process of political discussions, and the way to attract people was actually that. Otherwise, we would have been completely seen as, yeah, making grand demands, but completely out of touch with the reality with the world around you. You know, to a bigger extent is what you can see with Chavez. Yeah, of course. I mean, it's great that you have a country full of oil because it means that and you're doing a lot of dealings with oil because it means that you can build schools, hospitals. If that's happening any longer, that's another debate. But the thing is, do you want to be oil country forever? And that's the debate. Yeah, it's the reality where you are, you know? But do you want to be that forever? And not only that, you have to take into account as well that oil is at the base of the capitalist system, you know? If you want, not only do you want to diversify production of your country, but if you want as well socialism in any meaningful form to take place, you have actually to start breaking a type of culture that we've been living into for the last 200 years. That means to think differently. And some of the, and that's not something, I mean, when you're in a popular movement, you have to deal with these contradictions all the time. And if you're organized, and only if you've thought not in the terms of a campaign, but in a programmatical terms, I mean, in the next 15, 20 years' time, you're going to be able to give this debate properly. But the workers were putting it there, and they learned to struggle. You know, the workers were not probably very receptive to what anarchists in Venezuela had to say. They just saw it from their own experience. And they say, well, yeah, it might be that the government's solution is more profitable, but we don't have to think like that. We have to think of human life as a whole. That's what they said. And that shows you how socialism is a living experience of the working class. People learn it through struggle. And you have to be part of that struggle alongside people if you want to influence it in any meaningful way. You know? And that's kind of part of the debate. Now, I think it's around oil is a very relevant debate, because oil gives today countries like Venezuela an enormous power to pursue, I'm finishing this idea, to pursue an independent policy, a non-dependent policy. But at the same time, the oil culture is driving humanity to a crisis that's never been there, where humanity as a whole is in danger of extinction. You know, capitalism, for sure, has done numerous genocides throughout its history, and the conquest actually of the Americas is one of the best documented ones. But humanity as such was never at the risk of terror. Probably the only time in history that it was in the 80s with the nuclear threat. But the nuclear threat depended on the decision. Do I press the button or not? Today, we're not faced with a decision. We're faced with a reality that if we don't change significantly this culture in 60, 70 years' time, we face a serious risk of mass extinction. It's a prospect for the future if we don't change the way. And I think that all those things should be part of the revolutionary debate in Venezuela. Unfortunately, when the anarchists don't play their role, and the same is true for Venezuela as for anyone else, no one would put the demands there. And you can read anarchist pamphlets in Venezuela saying, no, the government is doing this, the government is doing that. But it's the government. Do you know what governments do? The problem is why anarchists are not there with the popular movement, in spite of all the contradictions, in spite of all the tough political options that they can put you, you know, doing their role. Anarchists shouldn't expect others to do their role, and they certainly shouldn't blame others for not doing what anarchists should be doing. That's the problem with anarchists.
Sorry,
Brenda,
I was going to say
does anyone have any? Bring anyone else in? Does anyone have any comments? Anything doesn't need to be perfect. Anything? Any comments, suggestions, questions?
About your through the communities in Venezuela, with Chavez, who was trying, as you said before, by participatory democracy, and do you think it was kind of forced on them?
Oh yes, certainly.
And do you think that makes, even if you know you did go through it, and things started happening, they started discontinuing from the power coming from below?
I wouldn't.
Coming up instead of coming from the central government.
There you go.
What about the point?
What about the point?
Later. Expensive 5-10 on the left.
Okay. I wouldn't say it was forced, alright? People were quite willing to take those elements of participatory democracy as long as they existed, you know, or as long as they were promised. But I would say that certainly top-bottom change is faces a serious problem. That it means that people don't see it as part of their own experience, you know, and they therefore don't see the potential that the people themselves have to change things to make it move forward. The thing is, whether given from above or emerging from below, and the best scenario is they emerge from below, you know, but whatever the case, the option was there to raise expectations on behalf of the revolutionary movement and to use those spaces in a different way. I'm going to give you some examples. ACNUR was formed in 1968 by the Colombian government as means to forcibly unionize peasants, so in order to avoid the emergence of guerrilla movements and kind of to put kind of a containment wall. Sure, the left all went en masse to support Akhnoor. And what happened is that Akhnoor was at the forefront of Pathan's struggle by early 70s, in spite of the original intentions. In Chile, the homeless movement started actually when the government started doing programs for housing in a very patronizing way, clientelistic way, to contain a mass of discontent that could erupt at any time. The left debated for a number of years if to go into those programs or not, and when they did, they could effectively turn them into very fertile soil for the revolutionary movement in Chile throughout the 70s. What I want to say is that you have to see the options, you have the possibilities you have, instead of taking a dogmatic approach to saying, oh, that was organized by the Chinese, I'm not going there. The problem is where the people are, what are the struggles, where you should be, and how can you be? And again, I'm coming back to the point, you know, I mean, it's easy to criticize, you know, chances for selling oil to the US, but it would be completely irresponsible if you stopped doing it. If you stop selling oil to the US, can you imagine the impact it will have for the working class in Venezuela? It's going to be a disaster. It's going to mean hunger. It's going to mean people dying of preventable diseases. And it's going to mean a lot of things that honestly don't want to happen, actually. The problem is, how do we put better conditions? How do we move forward from there? You know, and I think that none of those problems have an easy solution. And I don't think that it's enough sometimes to say, oh, it has to be bottom up. It has to be bottom up, but we have to know how to do it. And we have to be aware that it's a hard struggle, not only to deal with the bureaucracy, but at the same time to change a culture where we are accustomed to do what we are told. Like the workers were saying there, we were doing management, but we didn't know we were doing it. Potentially we could do it, but we just didn't realize. You know? What difference does it make to have a revolutionary movement there? It is the revolutionary movement that should be doing that clarity. You know, I'm saying, no, it's you, those who are doing it. Why do you have to give back there? But when the revolutionaries give that space to reformism, you don't have to expect a better result. That happened in Argentina as well. People very radical, taking over factories. I remember I was there in early 2002 when it was all happening, you know. People's assemblies all over the place. And the revolutionary movement discussing ideological petty stuff, fighting and quarreling inside the people's assemblies, dividing them, splitting them up according to their own factions, and in the end it was all gone. From the "we want them all out," that was the slogan back in 2001, they all stayed in power, and now they're stronger than ever.
That's probably why it probably differs as an anarchist, is the fact that in a revolution period, the importance of Prussian state right away, which for the example of Argentina, which you just mentioned there, the two, the dual power scenario, you had the factory, you had the council, you had the popular movement, cannot coexist with the state, because the state will eventually trample on that, crush it, destroy it, rip it apart. So for me, that therefore is essential if in times of social revolution, social unrest, they need to destroy the state straight away.
That's right, but again, you have a very difficult circumstance. That's possible if you have been a sizable majority from the start. It was possible in Spain, and they didn't do it because they didn't have the political vision to do it. You know, in Argentina, that was not an option.
It wasn't strong
in any form, because the anarchist movement was completely marginal. The problem is that during that time, the anarchist movement could have stopped being marginal because the anarchist discourse resonates in vast sections of the population, not only the left, I mean, just ordinary people. And actually, indeed, the anarchist movement grew enormously. I mean, movements like Augur, then they abandoned anarchism for some sort of populist paranism, but they grew from being a group of 6 lads to over 1,000. I mean, you can see it over that time. And obviously, that posed a number of anarchists all of a sudden were leading movements of unemployed people, of many thousand people, you know. But again, it was the lack of strategic vision, because yeah, at that time it wasn't a question of smashing straight with the state, but how you build the popular power necessary to do it in a revolutionary struggle that was not going to be immediate, but that would take some time, but where you couldn't go back an inch. And we've been going back and back and back and back and back again to the time of Fenelon.
it's the problem of reformism. Reformism, the path of reformism. It's good to be, obviously I'm for reforms, we have a different approach to winning reforms, but that's why we're not reformists, as in, but don't believe reforms in and of itself, but for necessarily of destroying the root cause of the problem, of rooting them.
Yeah, but at the same time it was a problem of spontaneous anarchism. Because many anarchists disregard the need of political organization because they say, oh no, but look, the people are doing it. Mm-hmm. Do you know? Yeah, the people are doing it because it's in the experience of the working class. But revolutionary progress shouldn't be taken for granted because they're part of an experience, of a historical experience, far longer than the lives of any one of us. You know? But they just question them. We can talk on what happened in Spain in 1936 because we've been exposed to that because of anarchism as such. You know, but people in Venezuela that took over the factories didn't have elements to know anything of Spain in the 1936 because it wasn't an issue in their lives ever. You know, but it would have made a big difference if they probably had heard about it because they could relate it to their own experience. They could say, Jesus Christ, yeah, class struggle is not enough, isn't it, son? Do you know what I mean? The thing is, I always thought, oh yeah, the people are doing it, but it was very interesting. I have a work, I don't know if you read it, it was one of the first articles in anarchismo.net actually, on self-management in Argentina. I would suggest you to revisit it because it's actually quite, it was written when all this was collapsing and we were saying people dismiss the role of political organizations and therefore we didn't have an organized and we didn't have a coherent force to move it forward. Same happened in Russia. People were doing factory councils, Soviets and all that, you know, and what were the artists doing discussing how wonderful was going to be when the utopia was going to be made. We're facing the day-to-day problems. Magnus said that, you know, in the Tristan Department. He said, if we have been organized, if we have had a program, if we have discussed the daily problems of the working class, not only the grand ideas, but few people will disagree with the basic ideas of anarchism anyway, you know, we would have been in a better position to be a revolutionary factor.
Does anyone have any more suggestions? Do you want to make any closing points or finish up here? It's 5 o'clock.
Yeah, 3 points. Problems, social problems are very difficult and we need to approach them in a realistic way while at the same time we know where we're heading. Secondly, we need to learn to work with others and that's very important too. And third, we need to be serious about ourselves and we need to be serious about our next organization because it's the only guarantee we have for our ideas to have any weight in social movements in the future. That's all.